Our next case is 11-1095, Ernest Hollingsworth versus Deb Timmerman Cooper, Warden. For the petitioner, Mr. Pagan.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, if I could reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Chris Pagan. I represent Mr. Hollingsworth. Today's case, our issue, involves Ohio criminal procedure and whether or not a no-contest plea in this particular case acts as a procedural bar in federal habeas to defeat adjudication of a federal constitutional claim in federal habeas. And I'd like to make 4 points, and then I'll sit down. The state's argument, the warden's argument here, asks you to take two unambiguous rules, Rule 11 and Evidence Rule 410, and engraft language upon them and engage in judicial legislation. The rule very plainly says that no contest pleas can't be used in subsequent civil proceedings, yet their argument requires the use of it. More specifically, they want a no-contest plea, or their argument depends on use of a no-contest plea for a specific purpose, and that is to prove waiver of my client's right to effective assistance in the federal habeas corpus proceedings. In reviewing Rule 11 and Evidence Rule 410, there's no room for that.
Basically what's being said here is when you waive by entering into a plea, you waive the ability to complain about an ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's their argument.
I understand that.
Yes.
And to get there, wouldn't there be a presumption that you're waiving the ability to object to your counsel's recommendation that you enter into a plea agreement that will constitute a waiver of that evidence or of that advice?
I have difficulty following that. You're hypothetical.
Well, if it's an all-encompassing waiver,
right,
and you're being – if you're the defendant here,
right,
you're being – you're entitled to have competent legal advice.
Right.
And you're waiving your ability to complain that you received incompetent legal advice, and that incompetent legal advice advised you to accept the plea.
Right. Right. So, correct.
And the problem I have with your initial premise is that the inability to use the plea in a subsequent hearing, which, you know, I've frequently had some objections to and dissented on that analysis, but your subsequent civil proceeding here is not a new proceeding. It's attacking the plea itself, the basis,
right,
itself, and none of the other uses, like in a subsequent car accident or attempt to recover injury or damages. It's a new proceeding. Here, you're trying to attack the very basis. I see a major distinction. It's not a new proceeding. You're attacking the validity of the actual original plea itself and the basis for it. And so I just find it very, very difficult to understand how you can do that without discussing the plea itself and how it happened and what went on and all the circumstances. That's the essence of what you're attacking in habeas.
Exactly. Let me dispute the premise of the point, and that is that it's the same proceeding. It's not. This court in Wilson said at least state post-conviction is a separate civil proceeding.
Yeah, it's a separate civil proceeding, but you're attacking the actual plea itself. And in none of the cases that the statute has applied to, are you attacking the plea itself? You're saying that guilty plea can't be used as any sort of admission in a subsequent event. Here, you're not doing that. You're just trying to undo the original plea itself.
Well, no, I make a distinction between attacking the plea itself and attacking the something else, which is the because here Hollingsworth wasn't attacking the plea primarily. He was attacking the fact that his attorney failed to do things in the motion to suppress, which is a separate question.
But he's trying to set aside the plea.
Pardon me?
He's trying to set aside the plea.
He's trying to, no, he's asking that the court set aside his state conviction because he received ineffective assistance in the course of the motion to suppress.
And in none of the other scenarios that statute applies to, do you set aside the original plea? You just can't use it as admission of anything else.
You can't use it as a waiver to prove ineffective assistance of counsel. Okay. Rule 11
said, a different way, Mr. Pagan.
I'm sorry.
Was an appeal from the plea, am I correct, to the appellate court, intermediate appellate court?
There was.
And that court considered the issues and affirmed the judgment of the trial court.
Correct. Are you talking about the direct appeal?
I'm talking about the direct appeal.
Yes, sir.
That's true.
And
then there was no appeal to this court from that determination. Am I right about that?
That is correct.
So that was the end of the substantive review
of the Fourth Amendment
criminal
issues.
Rule 11 plea.
Well,
and now, as Justice Stratton points out, there's a collateral attack on the substance of the plea in the federal court based on ineffective assistance of counsel, which was not presented to this court. So it was final and determinative when no appeal was filed to this court, and the judgment of the appellate court is the end of it.
There are a couple things that I would dispute in what you said. The direct appeal turned on the Fourth Amendment issue and whether or not the motion to suppress was properly granted. It did not involve ineffective assistance.
So any matter that isn't raised is presumably waived, is it not, on a direct appeal?
Except for ineffective assistance of claims that involve facts that are outside of the record. And in this case, what the attorney, the trial attorney, didn't put into the motion to suppress case was what was the claim of his ineffectiveness.
And you don't see that as a collateral attack on the plea?
No, I see that as a collateral attack on whether or not my client received his right to effective assistance under the Sixth Amendment.
I think I understand what you're arguing to us. Let me ask you a separate question. It occurs to me that the matter comes to us on a certified question of state law from the federal court, asking us whether the federal court should be applying our criminal rules or our evidentiary rules to a federal proceeding. Isn't that precluded by the Erie Doctrine?
I'll answer it this way, and you tell me if it's satisfying or not. In federal habeas litigation, I do a substantial amount of that. The federal courts apply Ohio's procedural laws and procedural bars. It doesn't make up its own. So you get to define what the statute of limitations are, and you get to define for presenting state federal constitutional claims in state court. You define res judicata. You define Rule 11 and Evidence Rule 410. That's your job. And the Supreme Court then applies that in federal law because a federal habeas court will not adjudicate a federal constitutional claim unless the state courts have had the opportunity to do it, or unless there's a procedural bar that prevents the litigant from presenting that claim to federal court. So,
well, let me try it a different way.
Maybe I'll answer it this way, and you tell me if this is insufficient too. In 1975, the U.S. Supreme Court decided the Lefkowitz case. The Lefkowitz case stands for the proposition that states get to define procedural bars. In the Lefkowitz case, what happened was is the criminal defendant in New York pled guilty to an offense after losing a motion to suppress. He took that issue, the Fourth Amendment issue, to the federal habeas court, and the state of New York said he pled guilty. It's a waiver of his Fourth Amendment claim. But there was a statute in New York that said guilty pleas don't waive Fourth Amendment claims. And the Supreme Court said that's right. New York defined its procedural bar there. New York law applies, and it says that you can present Fourth Amendment claims even over and above a guilty plea, and we're going to apply that. That's what I'm asking you to do here. I'm asking you to define Rule 11 and Evidence Rule 410 to apply just as it's written, to say that no contest pleas can't be used in federal, as a matter of state law, cannot be used in federal habeas proceedings to act as a procedural bar because state law doesn't provide for that.
But I think the challenge with your argument, I'll try the third time to ask it, is that you're asking us to ignore, to say that you don't consider the no contest plea at all. And if, in fact, you're alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, you have to consider the no contest plea and the advice that was given to your client prior to that plea being made. And so that becomes the complexity of your argument. You want us to overlay what, as Justice Stratton said, are civil concepts that you can't use an admission in a subsequent civil proceeding to say that the very essence of your claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, we can't consider the no contest plea.
Well, and maybe I didn't articulate this for well in my briefs. A no contest plea can be used in certain circumstances, but those circumstances are defined in Rule 11. So you could go to federal court and say, there are five things that you waive by doing a no contest plea.
I'm not talking about waiver. What I'm talking about is how do we consider whether the counsel was ineffective if we can't consider the facts and circumstances, including the no contest plea?
Well, his claim is more narrow than that. His claim is that my attorney didn't do certain things in the motion to suppress, and that's the defective performance from the ineffective assistance. And had he done those certain things, the result of the proceeding would have been different. It really doesn't include the advice he gave to plea.
But you attack that in the direct appeal, as Justice O'Donnell pointed out.
No.
In the direct appeal, wasn't the issue of the suppression hearing addressed?
Yes, on the record that was produced in the trial court. But the claim in post-conviction was that the trial attorney failed to produce evidence that was outside of the record that related to race discrimination for the particular police officer that conducted the stop, with respect to the failure to produce evidence with regard to the drug dog that did the alert. All those things were outside of the record. So we are litigating different questions.
But that wasn't evidence that was unknown at the time, or could not have been determined.
It was unknown to Hollingsworth.
It was unknown to Hollingsworth.
Right. Right. Maybe it was unknown to his trial attorney, maybe it wasn't. But that's the point of our litigation here, and we've never had that issue about the effectiveness of the litigation for the motion to suppress. We've never had that addressed on the merits. There's always been procedural bars that.
So what you're asking is to vacate the conviction, to go back, start over, and give him a new suppression hearing?
No, I'm asking that his judgment be thrown out because in the context of the ineffective assistance analysis, the defective performance would be that he failed to produce evidence that would have produced a winning motion to suppress. And had he done that,
Who has to determine whether that would have been a winning argument in a motion to suppress?
I'm sorry?
Who has to determine that, whether or not that would have been a winning argument that would have allowed for the suppression? Is that the federal court's responsibility?
Yes, at this point. I mean, we asked the state courts to do it, but it applied procedural bar all throughout the post-conviction proceeding, so we never had a determination on the merits.
Wait a second. You did raise it on your direct appeal as a substantive appeal.
Raised the issue of whether or not the motion to suppress that was litigated using the record evidence was a winning motion to suppress in the first instance.
You didn't introduce on the direct this evidence that you claim is there with regards to the fact that the dog was not trained and lacked current certificates and the alleged racial profiling of the patrol officer?
All of that was produced in the post-conviction record, which went up that way.
If you take your argument to its logical conclusion, you can't throw out this plea because this plea isn't admissible. This plea isn't in your case. So the federal court has no right to throw it out because it doesn't exist for your subsequent civil litigation.
That's taking it to the extreme, and that's not what I'm asking to do. I mean,
but I don't know how you can have your – well, I used the phrase the other one, have your cake and eat it, too.
I heard you say that a second ago.
you want him not to consider it for anything else, but then you want him to throw it out, but it doesn't exist in your new case.
No, I'm not saying you can't consider it I'm not saying it that extremely. I'm not. And Rule 11 says there are certain circumstances in which you can consider a no-contest plea for the waiver of the five trial rights, but outside of that, you can't. That's the argument. You can't.
Mr. Pagan, you're arguing Rule 11 to us, but why aren't you arguing Strickland versus Washington, ineffective assistance, and your burden to demonstrate that but for the ineffective assistance, the outcome would have been different, and there isn't any evidence of that here, is there?
That's an excellent point. Because there are
Thank
two...
you.
But it goes to, I mean, here's the...
Are you arguing that, doesn't that belong in the federal court?
We haven't gotten to that point yet, because the federal courts and the state courts have all applied procedural bar. No court has considered Strickland versus Washington yet, defective performance and prejudice, because in this case, they found that the no contest plea acted as a waiver of his right to ineffective assistance, and because we haven't even gotten to Strickland versus Washington, I'd love to get to Strickland versus Washington. That's the point of this. I'll sit down at this point and reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you. Ms. Cooley?
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. There are two critical points that I would like to establish at the outset. The first is that we are not arguing that a no-contest plea waives a defendant's rights to bring ineffective assistance of counsel claims or to otherwise challenge the validity of his conviction. The federal court did analyze his claims on the merits and determined that he had failed to attack his plea, and that is why his claims had failed. What we are arguing is that when a defendant chooses to resolve his case by plea, there are well-settled constitutional limits that apply to his later constitutional claims. And the Ohio no contest plea is not designed to topple those constitutional requirements. Mr. Hollingsworth's argument, when taken to its logical conclusion, does require the court to simply pretend his no contest plea doesn't exist. And under this court's precedent, these Ohio rules mean that both the plea and conviction cannot come into play. That is why the federal court assumed it would be absurd for them to apply to this context. The Ohio rules do not permit a defendant to escape the fundamental consequence of his plea, which is his acceptance of criminal punishment. And there are two reasons why these Ohio rules do not apply when a defendant attacks the conviction itself. First of all, these collateral proceedings are not the kinds of proceedings contemplated by the rules. And second, they fall squarely within this court's exception in State versus Mapes.
Well, I want to back up to what you led off with. You said that you're not asserting that the entering of a no contest plea would bar attacking ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So how does one do that?
How does one raise ineffective assistance claims after entering a no contest plea?
Yes.
One has to mediate one's claims through the no contest plea. Anything that came before the entry of the plea may play a part in your claims, but at the end of the day, you have to show that you received incompetent legal advice at the plea stage, that your decision to admit to the facts that constitute a crime.
When does that take place, procedurally?
When does
the attack or the appeal,
so,
the ability to use the plea and conviction?
That can happen in a couple of instances. It can happen in the federal habeas context. You can raise that as part of your ineffective assistance of counsel claim. That's built into the standard in Hill versus Lockhart, which this court also applies, requires you to show that bad advice of counsel led you to enter into your plea. Therefore, the court should set aside your plea because at the end of the day, it was unknowing and involuntary, and that decision prejudiced you. The decision to enter the plea is a strategic choice. The benefits that are provided by the no contest plea are not that you can ignore the plea itself when you attack the conviction.
Well, I still want to back up to where I started with my question. Your answer was you can mediate the ineffective assistance of counsel prior to entering the plea. Is that what you said?
No, Your Honor, I'll clarify. What I mean is that your plea is what your conviction rests on. You have decided to enter a plea as the means of resolving your criminal case. And so at that point, your constitutional claims have to connect. They have to bridge the gap. and show why your plea should be knocked down. So for an example of this suppression hearing issue, if your counsel advised you to plead no contest but never raised a motion to suppress in the first place or never investigated some critical defense adequately, you could argue that the advice to plead no contest at that point was insufficient representation and your plea should be set aside.
And you argue that in the federal habeas case?
What we argued in the federal habeas case was that Mr. Hollingsworth had simply never connected whatever had happened before his plea to the fact that to his decision to enter his plea. He never bridged that gap. It was a merits issue, and maybe he can make that claim, maybe he can't. But at the end of the day, the Ohio rules are not designed to exclude the plea entirely from the claims that he has to bring. And the federal
court. Where would he have brought the action to, as you say, bridge the gap? Would it have been on his direct substantive appeal to the Court of Appeals or in the federal court where he is now?
He could have done it in his Ohio post-conviction and his federal habeas case in both of those contexts. On direct appeal, he can raise the merits of his suppression issue, which he did. He got his second bite at the apple.
Okay, so the Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court's ruling on the suppression.
That's correct.
Okay. Then as far as the ineffective, the post-conviction avenue, what happened there?
The claims were denied on the merits. Then there was a procedural bar that was applied that has nothing to do with this case. But the federal court decided not to apply the procedural bar. The federal court looked at the merits of his claims and determined that they failed because he never explained why his plea should be set aside, why he didn't know what he was doing when he made the strategic choice to enter into his no contest plea. The rules that would keep the plea and conviction out completely simply do not apply here because they're designed for a totally different context. The subsequent civil or criminal proceedings contemplated by these rules are those proceedings in which the defendant faces subsequent civil or criminal consequences on account of his plea. They're designed to confine the effects of the plea to the criminal punishment that the defendant is accepting, to not lead to financial consequences or civil liability.
So, counsel, basically what you're saying is he had a roadmap on how to argue that his counsel was ineffective. He did it, could have done it. In the direct appeal to the Court of Appeals, he could have done it on post-conviction relief to the state courts. And both of those options were litigated, and he failed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so now being in the habeas realm of the federal court is not going to give him a third or fourth bite at the apple using the rules, which are not meant for this type of a disposition.
That's correct, Your Honor. The only qualification I would add is that, I mean, maybe he can bring that claim, but he just hasn't done it yet.
Where can he bring it?
I'm sorry. What I mean is that it's the federal court can analyze the merits of his claim. He's failed to present a colorable claim so far. So you are correct. That is my argument.
Does he have that ability now in the federal habeas action to do this?
I think that he would have to deal with habeas principles that hold him to what has happened, what he's already litigated in post-conviction. So he would be limited if he hasn't followed the roadmap that was laid out to him. But that's something that he can raise to the federal court. He's had his opportunity to do that.
Well, what specifically did he leave out of his habeas petition that should have been in it? And I'm still not sure I'm following you from point A, B, C to D, which is federal habeas. But you seem to be saying there was a way for him to present his claim of ineffective assistance of counsel in advising him to roll with a no contest plea. There was a way for him to get that before a federal judge in the federal habeas claim, and he didn't include it in his habeas petition.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
And what specifically did he fail to include in his habeas petition?
He failed to attack his plea. He failed to show that his plea was unknowing or involuntary. And the rules that are designed to keep the plea in conviction...
failed to show gets you... That would be an evidentiary question.
Sure. He failed to allege is really what I meant to say.
All right. So he failed to plead it.
Correct. The rules are forward-looking. What he's doing in his collateral proceedings is backward-looking. He's trying to get out from under his plea. He's getting out from under the fact that he hasn't followed the clear roadmap that was in place when he entered into his plea. The plea is simply doing what it was intended to do here. The two benefits that Ohio law provides are not what he's arguing here. Again, they provide him with the opportunity to avoid civil liability as an incentive to resolve his case this way. If the world looks the way Mr. Hollingsworth wants it to look, the no contest plea can't be a means of ever resolving anything because the state can't really respond to his claims by producing the very thing on which his conviction rests, the plea. For that matter, this court said in Elevators Mutual that the plea and conviction travel together. So how could the state even respond with the conviction? And that is plainly absurd. The law contemplates in lots of ways that post-conviction and habeas corpus proceedings are tied back to the criminal conviction itself.
Although counsel, under the rule, we're talking about a civil proceeding, correct? Habeas is a civil proceeding.
Yes, Your Honor.
It is a subsequent civil proceeding, is it not?
Not within the meanings of the rules, Your Honor. If subsequent meant anything later in time, it would include the direct appeal, and that would be absurd here. Saying that the no contest plea cannot be used against the defendant in subsequent civil or criminal proceedings is another way of saying that the no contest plea cannot lead to subsequent civil or criminal consequences. That is not what Mr. Hollingsworth faces here. He is trying to undo the existing consequence of his plea. They plainly have no place in this context.
All right. So we are talking about 11B2.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. It seemed that we were going in different directions, and I had thought this was really related to whether that rule applied or did not apply.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the consequences of a no contest as opposed to a guilty plea, for example.
That's correct, Your Honor. The no contest plea, though, doesn't change the fundamental consequence, which is the defendant's admitting to the facts that constitute a crime.
But not the guilt.
Correct, Your Honor, not the guilt. There is another reason why the rules don't apply here, and that's because of this court's MAPES exception. MAPES provides that the rules do not apply when a statute has made the conviction relevant. These statutes expressly reference the underlying conviction. They require him to attack the conviction. And indeed, this case is an even stronger case for the MAPES exception than MAPES itself. Everything we do in post-conviction and habeas proceedings is predicated on the conviction. Everything that happens at those proceedings presumes that the conviction exists. The conviction and plea are the very target of his attack. It would be absurd to exclude the very thing he has to attack to prevail on his claims. MAPES has never been limited. Mr. Hollingsworth has failed to cite an example where it has been limited or a reason why. And indeed, the MAPES exception makes sense. It recognizes that these Ohio rules serve a very specific purpose, and that is that they prevent the defendant from facing civil liability on account of his plea. Where that purpose is not at issue, and they're conflicting with some legislative scheme like post-conviction statutory relief, or where they're conflicting with important policy purposes in the rules, those other rules that are completely separate should not apply here.
Ms. Curley, can you help us in the resolution of the instant matter that's before the court? We have a question from a federal court asking us for a response to a specific question. If we agree with your view, how would we respond to this certified question, and what would you have us incorporate into our opinion?
Your Honor, the answer to the question would simply be no. The Ohio rules governing the subsequent consequences of a no contest plea simply have no place when the defendant is collaterally attacking the underlying conviction.
That is how you would answer the certified question. The question has been certified here because the court wants to understand, it wants to make sure that these rules aren't designed to untether, completely free the defendant from his plea, permit him to pretend it doesn't exist in the collateral attack, and that's plainly not what these rules are designed to do. This court drafted these rules. This court designed them for a particular purpose. This is not the purpose that they're designed to serve. I would, you know, cite.
Do these rules need modification in your view?
No, Your Honor, not
Couldn't
for.
Could we better address this issue?
No, Your Honor, not for the purposes of answering this question, because I think it's plain how they apply, and I think there is a textual interpretation that makes sense. I would add that these rules exist in the majority of the states, and they are also in the federal rules. They specifically, those other states and the federal rules specifically say that it's inadmissible or can't be used in any civil or criminal proceeding. Mr. Hollingsworth hasn't cited one example of these rules being used to get him out from under his plea in a collateral attack.
Have other jurisdictions dealt with a similar question?
They have, Your Honor. I believe South Carolina has. It doesn't come up much because I think the rules are well, the constitutional rules governing the defendant's claims are well settled. I think that the best way to understand these rules is that they're designed to encourage the defendant to resolve his case by plea, by confining the plea, by keeping it from spilling over into other contexts.
Thank you.
Right now we're talking about the conviction. Thank you very much, and I would request that you answer no to the certified question.
Thank you.
The point that illustrates the difference in our arguments is this. The state, through the warden here, came and told you that the federal court decided the ineffective assistance claim on the merits. That's not true. That's absolutely not true. And the reason that that's not true is because the federal court doesn't need any help from you in resolving a federal constitutional claim on the merits. The reason the case is before you is because the federal court decided the case on procedural bar, specifically that the no contest plea in this case operated as a waiver of my client's constitutional right to present an ineffective assistance claim.
So, counsel, in a sense, they took 11B2 and they said that it applied in this particular case, or it did not apply in
did
this
not
particular.
Apply.
And
I'm
you're
saying,
it does.
I'm saying that the plain reading of the rule would prevent a no contest plea for being used in these circumstances.
Because this is a subsequent civil proceeding? Is that your view?
Absolutely. And it's being used to prove a waiver of a constitutional right that has no part in a no-contest plea colloquy. In no-contest pleas, you waive five constitutional rights. Those are five trial rights. Waiver is an intentional relinquishment of a known right. There was no discussion at his plea colloquy about ineffective assistance, and how could he have known what his attorney failed to do? So the use of a no-contest plea in this case by plain application of Rule 11 and Evidence Rule 410 is precluded. And I'm sorry, I want to make a point. And the policy that undergirds Rule 11 and Evidence Rule 410 is being promoted by my argument. My client was enticed to enter a no-contest plea because there was no dispute that he possessed this marijuana. None.
But can I go back to what you just said? Because
yes, ma'am.
When you said, well, of course he couldn't waive his ineffective assistance because he didn't know. That's the very reason Rule 11 doesn't apply. It's not part of that colloquy.
Right.
Because your argument is, well, he couldn't know what his attorney didn't do.
Right.
Because the court did ask him if he was satisfied with his lawyer, according to the record, and he said, yes, very much so.
Right.
And so I don't think that supports your argument. Rule 11, I don't understand how you contend that it complies, that it should be one of the enumerated waivers. Even if we amended the rule and included it as a waiver, how could a defendant stand up and waive something he doesn't know whether it's been ineffective or not?
Exactly, but that's what the federal court did to Mr. Hollingsworth. It said, your no-contest plea operates as a waiver of your ineffective assistance of counsel, and you can't bring it forth in habeas. And my point is, how could he know? It's not in Rule 11. And it reconfigures what we understand waiver to be, which is a intentional relinquishment of a known right. apply Rule 11 and Evidence Rule 410 as written to avoid that absurdity.
I don't see the evidence rule as applying, but if we say that Rule 11 doesn't apply, then it's up to the federal court to decide how to evaluate your ineffective assistance claim. Because if there's no procedural bar, if Rule 11 doesn't apply, the answer is no, then it's up to the federal court to decide the case on the merits, isn't it?
But the federal court is being caught up in what Ohio state law is with respect to procedural bar here. So it has to address what your view of Rule 11 is.
Or maybe it's simply a red herring.
Well, if I understood the warden's argument correctly, you can allege in the habeas petition that the plea was not entered voluntarily or knowledgeably because of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yeah, they're
Are you saying the federal court will not entertain that argument either?
It should, because that's just a pure federal constitutional question about whether or not the ineffective assistance of counsel was pled and proved right. It doesn't need your help for that. What it needs your help for is what it did, which is to use state law as a procedural bar so that Hollingsworth ineffective assistance of counsel claim never gets adjudicated at all, because a state procedural law relating to no contest pleas bars consideration.
So you and opposing counsel are saying two different things. You're saying that if the rule on no contest pleas is inapplicable, then it's a procedural bar. You can't raise your issue in any way. And opposing counsel says, well, even if it is inapplicable, you can still raise it by pleading something else.
At this point, I couldn't because of exhaustion and statute of limitations.
Right. Let's say you were to go back. I'm not necessarily you, but your client was to go back to the beginning. Right. Is opposing counsel's roadmap correct in your view?
Perhaps, but then they might be able to use the same argument that the federal court relied upon here, which is.
Counsel, would you go to the microphone, please?
Sorry. The import of what the federal judge decided here was no contest plea waives an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and whether or not that claim relates to plea advice, whether or not it was ineffective regarding plea advice or ineffective in the way the motion to suppress was conducted, a bar is a bar is a bar, the way I look at it. So I disagree with what they're saying.
Right. Thanks, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, would you call a recess, please?